I'm Wilson Lai.
I'm Benjamin Yap.
I'm Eli Sands.
You're listening to Deep Cut.
We're just three raw men talking about ramen.
Kill me now.
On Deep Cut, we compare a director's most popular film with a personal favorite chosen by one of us.
We also discuss that director's life and career to bring in context that helps us view their movies as they may want us to.
Today, we are starting our exploration into one of my most recent director obsessions, Juzo Itami. And on this episode, we'll be discussing his most popular film, which is Tampopo, which was made in 1985. So, Tampopo was not as widely received locally in Japan as opposed to, like, some of his other films, which includes his first feature, The Funeral, which got him, like, a ton of award, like, local nominations and awards for the film, and it really, like, blasted him into fame as a film director. But Tampopo was the film that really captured the eyes of critics and other directors out west, and sort of is what Itami is known for in the more general, like, Western film canon. And I think through the decades has become, I think, on average, his most popular film. And, like, especially in, like, our circles, people only know Itami for Tampopo. Like, I don't think that they... Like, there has been a slight creeping up of people watching other Itami films because of their availability on streaming services like the Criterion Channel, which has, I think, it has all of his features and the short that he made called Rubber Band Pistol, which is really good. But I think this Tampopo is sort of a great entry into a really deep filmmaking world that he had created in the 10 features that he made before his untimely death.
I think for me, like, I don't think I've really registered his name much when people talk about Japanese film directors that, I don't know whether you call it the canon, but, like, when people talk about more famous Japanese directors,
right,
Itami's name doesn't really come up that much, but Tampopo does come up as itself, as a film. Yes. And it's pretty interesting how he doesn't really come up in conversation. So I'm really glad we're going to get into it.
Yeah.
And I've still only seen Tampopo at this point.
And I think it's going to be really fun because the past, like, couple weeks gearing up to this, I sort of, like, caught up on, at this point, I have probably seen 7 of Itami's features. Mm-hmm. And they are all really unique in their own way, but he is still able to maintain a similar tone or attitude towards his filmmaking, which is sort of like, I will make what I want to make. Like, an interview that his wife and frequent collaborator as an actress, Nobuko Miyamoto, she gave an interview on one of the, like, the anniversaries of Tampopo, and they were talking about, after his first feature, The Funeral, what he wanted to make next. And he was sort of debating on what to do to make the most, like, commercially viable film. And she says that she told him, why don't you make a movie that you want to make? And that is what birthed Tampopo.
I'm really glad that you chose Juzo Itami, Wilson. I'd love to know some more about his life.
Yes, I'm going to give a very brief intro to his life, and I think I'm going to sort of quickly gloss over the end of his life, because I want to maybe talk about it a little more next week.
Ooh.
When we get into Supermarket Woman, and I will talk about Supermarket Woman in the context of some of his other features, which might have gotten into muddy water, which might or might not have led him to his death. I'm saying a lot of things. Whoa. that are very nothing's confirmed.
Sounds like speculation.
There's a lot of speculation, but I think there's a lot of there's a lot of evidence in favor of the speculation.
I have no idea what we're talking about.
Yeah, I have no context whatsoever.
I think I would rather, like, introduce us to, like, his world and, like, all the good stuff first, and then we can get into the more sour stuff next week.
Oh boy, that's a nice pitch for our next week's episode.
So, Juzo Itami was born in Kyoto in May 15th, 1933. He was the son of a renowned satirist and film director, who's his dad. After failing a college entrance exam for a college of engineering at Osaka University, Itami started veering into more artistic industries like a commercial designer, a TV reporter, a magazine editor, and an essayist. He finally started studying acting and started acting in 1960, was doing a lot of work there, married an actress, got divorced to an actress. And then he was working with another popular Japanese director, Nagisa Oshima, on a film, A Sing a Song of Sex. And that's where he met his future wife, Nobuko Miyamoto. And they married in 1969.
Nice.
I think it's a really important relationship to have because she has basically been in all of his films, and she has been the lead in most of his films. And I think when talking about Itami's work as a whole, it's impossible to not talk about Miyamoto's work alongside his work. Mm. He directed his first feature at the age of 50, which is already pretty old.
Oh, wow.
He made The Funeral, and it really, like, kickstarted him as a film director, and the movie that we're going to talk about today, Tampopo, is what gave him the international acclaim, and it is his self-described ramen western. Before I was, like, making this note sheet, I put at the top of the episode, what the fuck is a ramen western? And after watching the documentary, the making of documentary, which was really helpful in my research for this episode, he very clearly explains why Tampopo is a Western. He says, it is like Shane, but about ramen. I have not seen Shane, but I guess it makes sense to him.
I see it. I see it.
You see it. You see it. I think you have a lone trucker or a trucker with a sidekick who comes into town, finds a rundown ramen shop, helps the lady who runs the ramen shop to become the best ramen shop in Japan, and then leaves at the end. So it is sort of like a lone rider coming in to save the day.
Is that what happens in Shane?
I don't fucking know.
Is that like a bar in Shane that needs to be spruced up? Okay, sorry, I don't know Shane either.
In the Western, there's the classic lone rider who comes into town and often staves off a threat, either gets rid of a bad person or helps protect the town from external threat. In Tampopo, of course, there's no external threat, but it's just about surviving as a ramen shop and perfecting a craft.
Yeah.
The other component that I see is that Goro and Tampopo assemble a little community around the shop, like a little family of people who are working on the shop to help Tampopo improve her skills.
You brought up a really good point there, Eli, about the family. And I think this is a really big through line through Itami's films, is that he always likes to have a large cast. And even though Tampopo is probably on the end of the spectrum, which is probably the most, like, fragmented film that he's made, in his other films, he always manages to get, like, all his, like, regular players in. A bunch of faces that you see in this film, you will see again when we watch our next movie, next episode. I think he, being an actor turned director, you can really tell that Itami loves working with actors and how, as an actor, you can, like, sort of make yourself malleable enough to embody such different characters. And he does this most prominently with Miyamoto, because she stars in a lot of his films. But the types of women that she gets to play is so, like, absolutely incredible and probably so fun to embody. I keep on thinking about Jenna Rollins and Cassavetes and that working relationship. And although the tones of Itami's work and Cassavetes' work are so incredibly far from each other, the types of characters that he
just try to think of a Cassavetes version of Tampopo now.
A Cassavetes Tampopo would be so crazy and deranged.
Deranged, okay.
Like, yeah. Just, no, like, sad, right? Like, because it's not going to be, like,
angry.
Like, fun and sexy. It's just going to be, like, sad and, like...
Sad and unsexy.
And sexy.
Like, people will be sad naked, but it'd still be unsexy.
And, like, crying while eating noodles.
It's just cup noodles, right?
Would be rough.
Noodles in the nude.
Before we get really into Tampopo, I'm going to close out this director bio by saying... He made a movie called Mimbo, The Gentle Art of Japanese Extortion. The movie is about how this woman played by Nobuko Miyamoto comes into this hotel, which is overrun by gang members, and she helps the hotel deal with gang members through... They just, like, try different strategies, and it's just very fun.
That sounds great.
It is really great, and how they, like, stick up to the different gang members. After it was released, Itami was attacked by members of a Yakuza clan.
Of course.
And he was slashed in the face.
What?
And he actually talked about it in an interview that he gave to the New York Times. And it was very, like, scary about how, I guess, his film was so effective that it actually struck a chord with real Yakuza. But I guess that is sort of related to his death. Which it was an apparent suicide where he fell off of the roof of a building where his office was located, and then they found a suicide note saying that he was falsely accused of an affair and he like took his life. But subsequent reports seem to say otherwise, especially with his history with the Yakuza. And he's also, like, after he got attacked by the Yakuza, he was still a big proponent for fighting against the Yakuza, and I don't think they never had a stable relationship ever since that start.
Him and the Yakuza just had an unhealthy, toxic relationship.
Yeah, it's not.
Don't we all have bad relationships with gigantic, I don't know, organizations of organized crime?
Yeah. I guess so. But that is, I guess, the main reason why his death is a little iffy to talk about and to make claims about because I also don't want any Yakuza member to come after us. This
fair enough.
Really lowly film podcast.
The deep cut is for movies, not for my face.
Yeah.
Yeah. Wow.
But let's dive into this bowl of ramen. What do you guys think of this movie?
Hungry for the hungry boy.
And this is not the first time. This is everyone's plus one time of seeing the movie.
Yep.
It's as good as I remember. It's so much fun. That's all I can say. Like, I got really lucky because when I first watched it, I managed to watch it on a big screen. So that was incredible to be engulfed by a gigantic bowl of ramen.
Yeah.
And it really just holds up, and you're surprised by how well the tangents kind of come together. Like, it's pretty much random how they kind of just string these vignettes of food-related stories together, but it works, and you never feel lost or confused by what the hell you're looking at. And it's pretty interesting how he keeps your attention throughout everything. I was just paying really close attention to all those kind of tangents, and every single one of them is interesting. They're all fun, and maybe not all necessarily completely fun, some dark and morbid, and even those are really well done.
What do you mean cooking a meal for your family on your deathbed can't be fun?
Oh, that's exactly the one I was thinking about.
That's maybe the one vignette that doesn't work for me, but but we'll get
really,
into that.
It really kind of worked for me.
I was laughing the entire time this time I was just like, watching it.
I was just like, this is dark.
And, it's insane.
Yeah, it's pretty insane.
Actually, maybe it does work. I don't know. We'll talk about it. I first encountered Tampopo at its restoration a few years ago. I watched it at the Film Society of Lincoln Center, now known as Film at Lincoln Center, a slightly less cool name if you ask me. I love seeing it on the big screen. I went to go see it alone at an afternoon showing. I think I double featured it with The Handmaiden, which was kind of a wacky choice.
Wild.
And then immediately after I saw Tampopo, I went to a ramen place that was right next door to where I was living at the time. And it was great. Because this movie, it absolutely loves food. And there's a special place in my heart for movies that love food. It conveys the joy of cooking for people, of eating good food, and eating good food in company with people you care about.
Mm.
It's such a vivacious movie. Really fun watch. I love it.
I was also so lucky to see it for the first time on a big screen.
We're all three very lucky.
I know. I saw it at the Wesleyan Film Series. Shout out to the Wesleyan Film Series when they programmed it one night. And I was like, this has been on my watch list for ages. I have to go and see it. And I saw it. And it was one of the most incredible movie-going experiences I've ever had. And the only horrible, horrible, horrible thing is that when I got out of the theater, it was too late to go to edit to get any food.
That's
and
tragic.
I guess I had to settle for a grilled cheese, which is
okay.
not a bowl of ramen, but it is a very hearty meal. And
yeah.
I love Tampopo so much. I'm a massive food fan. I love ramen. I love Japanese food.
Iron Chef Australia.
Master Chef Australia, Eli. Oh, got it wrong. I spent 10 minutes plugging it in our Best of 2020 episode.
10 minutes
you got it
edited
wrong.
Down.
But I personally get a lot of joy eating food and making food for people and just watching people eat. And this is just the embodiment of why I love food. And it is, like a lot of other Itami films, it is a movie that is showing people who are good or who become good at what they do. And I just love watching that happen. It's like it sort of like goes back to Wiseman. It's like it's showing the like the business of business, and the business in this film is food, which is incredible.
The film critic Mike D'Angelo has one of the popular reviews of Tampopo on Letterboxd, and he has a really interesting take on it, which is I think bang on, which is that it's honestly a better comparison to sports movies than it is to a Western.
Yeah.
Because it essentially is a very long training montage.
It really is.
With random tangents, but yeah. It's essentially just Tampopo getting good at making ramen. That's it. And going through the training and learning about ramen.
If you think about it, the whole plot of the movie is a process sequence, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's all about the process of getting better at this craft. And that is also similar to a sports movie or other sort of getting better at craft movies. Like, whatever, Whiplash, Black Swan, whatever you want to say. They have shared DNA, for sure.
And what's so great is now that you know this, most of his other features, especially the ones that Nobuko stars in, are just like this, but in different contexts, in different
all sports
settings.
Movies?
Yeah!
Wait, what?
That's great.
So you're saying Supermarket Woman is about her becoming a really good supermarket woman? I don't know what that means.
Ooh, yeah, we'll see. We'll see, Ben. You might be right on the ball on that one.
What is a super, like, a person who works there or a person who shops there?
A person who works there and manages the supermarket.
It's, okay.
It's gonna be such a blast. I can't wait to talk about that movie. But this movie.
A really fun element that's baked into that kind of sports movie mold is that there is an implicit promise that the protagonist is going to win and get good at what they want to get good at, right? that provides a safety net under the movie that permits space for the vignettes and digressions so that even when the plot is not marching forward, you're just having fun and going with it, and you know that it's going to end up okay. That's the promise of a comedy in general, perhaps, but I think also in a sports movie.
I mean, he straight up just has, like, very sports-type images and actions.
And music.
Yeah, the music as well. She was doing a speed cooking, and she does the gymnastics pose.
Yeah.
And then he has the stopwatch. Like, that stuff is great. And then she's running. Like, I really love all that kind of stuff. And the way that he's just mashing random ideas together to form a really kind of funny situation that is kind of heightened but also makes sense is really joy to watch.
It is, I guess, a very simple premise and a simple plot, but I think that the addition of the tangential scenes really, like, balance it out and add weight to the other, like, chunks of the film. Hmm. And also is like a good breather for the audience who is really invested in Tampopo's character and wanting her to succeed. But also there are other interests like sex and French food.
The thing that I find in common with all the vignettes is that it is about the ways in which food connects people.
Should we talk about the woman who dies cooking the last meal for her family?
Yeah, there are a series of vignettes. I tried to write them all down.
I wrote them all down.
Did you write them all down? So the first one is during the middle of a training montage that we have. You see Tampopo and Goro, who's the cowboy figure who's training her. They're going on a run, and then you see a group of businessmen like sort of like walk towards the camera, mm-hmm. And you're like, "What's going on here?" And then the camera just decides to like leave Tampopo and Goro and follow these businessmen. And the first tangent is these rich people ordering French food and not really knowing what to order. And then the lowliest, like, assistant who is joining in on this meal has the greatest food knowledge and really shows off his ordering skills in front of them and embarrasses all the other CEOs of this company. And it's so fun. And there's, like, this really jittery handheld camera movement as they walk into the room and the waiter goes around to each of them that gives you a sense of unease that the businessmen are feeling in the moment, with unable to understand the food that they're ordering. At the end, the last bit of it is really great because he finishes his order, the assistant who is really cocky with his order, and then it pans to all the other businessmen on the table, and their faces are bright red. And
like, unrealistically so.
Unrealistically bright red. And in the making of documentary, Itami probably devotes 5 minutes of this documentary just talking about how he did different screen tests with different powders to achieve the reddest look that he could possibly get. There is so much that you learn about this movie from the making of documentary. It is insane. I think it's my favorite making of documentary I've ever watched. It is Itami narrates the entire thing. And, like, when he talks about his actors, he runs through, like, every single actor in this movie and gives them, like, a sentence, and, like, why he chose this person for the role, nice. Why they're great for the role, or how he'd worked with them before. And he highlights, like, cinematographers, the food stylists, the sound editors, and shows different aspects of the filmmaking process. That includes, like, time spent in, like, costume fittings and him explaining over narration, like, why costuming is so important. And this is so interesting for us as, like, film lovers, but also as a person who doesn't know that much about movie making on a large scale. I think it is very informative because he sort of like guides you through it with his narration on what makes a movie and what is important to note, and Who are the people that you have to rely on? Mm. And it is really, it's such a joy to watch him gush about his crew members, because that is very important.
He's making a community too.
It sounds like he cared about found families and teams both on screen and off.
Yes, definitely. Definitely.
I want to go back to that vignette, the one about the... I call him an intern in my notes because that's kind of how they treat him. It's emblematic of many of the... not all, but many of the tangents that he's able to use a very short scene to kind of not just talk about food, but also about culture in general, which I think is very interesting, because what you have here is essentially a comment on social hierarchy, right? Like,
yeah.
And it sounds like I'm maybe making it sound more intellectual than it is, but it's very... It just makes sense when you watch it. Like yes, in a company, there is a CEO, there's an intern, but it doesn't mean that that power structure appears in all facets of life, right? You can have the intern show the other guy, for this moment, it's food, but it kind of makes this comment about how, like, power is not simple. How intelligent or how smart you are is not dependent on your position in a company or whatever. And I find it really interesting. And the following vignette after that is the one where the ladies are learning spaghetti eating etiquette.
Yeah.
And that's also really interesting because it's a comment about cultural exchange, right? Because you have Japanese women learning how to eat spaghetti, and then there's a white guy who is eating spaghetti.
It's ramen.
Yeah. And he's eating it. I mean, it doesn't say like where he's from, but in a sense,
America.
Spaghetti is a white kind of food. Yeah. You know what I mean? Yeah. So... And you have these Japanese women trying to learn how to eat spaghetti the right way, and he's slurping it up. And then it's just a very interesting juxtaposition to hear a Japanese woman telling you the right way to eat spaghetti, and then watch a white man just do it exactly the opposite way that she's saying, and watching chaos ensue when all the Japanese ladies are just gulping it down. It says a lot about how etiquette as an idea travels to a different country but doesn't necessarily stay in its country of origin. Right. Mm. And that's just fascinating to think about. And it's such a throwaway scene, and it makes that kind of juicy comment and then just leaves it.
The other thing that these two vignettes, which are back to back in the movie, is wringing humor out of is that both of the groups of Japanese characters in these vignettes are looking at European or so-called Western culture as the superior or so-called Western culture as the marker of superiority, right? The intern is so high class because he understands French culture and French cooking. And the group of Japanese women are trying to eat in the ostensibly polite, quiet Western way. Mm-hmm. But Itami is poking holes in that and wringing humor out of that hierarchy, out of that cultural hierarchy, which is, of course, fallacious.
And, oh man, then this just loops back into thinking about the fact that this movie is about ramen, which is a food enjoyed by everyone in Japan, right? Which they show throughout the whole movie, like, people of all walks of life. And in their sense, they're, in a sense, elevating the art of ramen making.
Yeah.
And they're elevating it, but at the end of the day, Tampopo's style of ramen that they keep saying is that they're trying to make normal ramen the normal way. And that's the so-called epitome of ramen, normal ramen, which is really interesting, like, as a way of going at this. You know, she's not trying to make, you know, weird French fusion ramen, blah, blah, blah. I've seen this. Like, there's this lobster bisque ramen place in Singapore. Yeah, so okay, they're not trying
I've
to be fancy.
I've had lobster bisque ramen, and it's really good, just so you know.
I'm sure it's good. But you know what I mean? It's just really interesting. Like, he's just trying to say, you know, this back-to-basic stuff, this is still just as good as all other food, right?
Yeah.
And that form fits function in other places, too, like, thinking about the choice of genres of Western and comedy, it keeps it accessible to a wide audience while still having specificity and an incisive thing to say about culture and nationality.
Mm-hmm.
And I also think that accounts for Tampopo's international success as well.
Definitely. Mm-hmm. And that reminds me of something that Nobuko Miyamoto said in an interview, where she said that there were three things that Juzo Itami aimed for when he was making his films. The first, that they have to be surprising. The second one is that they have to be fun. And the third one is that anyone can understand them. Nice. And that's, like, such a baseline level. But if you, like, have that mentality when you approach making, like, every single scene in your movie, it really ends up making it such a joyful experience to watch the movie. And I think he is always considering audience enjoyment, and that is, like, at the top of his mind at, like, every point when making this movie.
Now that we're still on the vignettes, what are your what are your each of your favorite vignettes from this?
I'm trying to recall them all.
Okay, I'm gonna run through a few things that I noted down. There's a sex scene and the oyster scene, a little related. The yes. dentist scene, really interesting. Ice cream kit, which is this connected also to dentist.
Connected to the dentist, yes.
Then peach my favorite grandma.
One, yeah, my favorite one is the peach grandma, where an old lady runs into a grocery store
and just molesting everything. Like, what the heck? It's like horrifying to watch in such a funny way. You're like, yeah. Why are you doing this? So aggravating to watch.
The physical comedy in that scene is so great with the clerk that's chasing after her.
And her face is so funny when she is first caught with the peach.
Yeah.
And then she's just like, oh, and then she just kind of drops it. There's no, you know, big question here, but it's just really fun. You know yes. what I mean? And really well constructed. And just takes, because that person exists. The person who goes around to supermarkets and just pokes all the all the food. That's a thing that happens. Especially in Asian supermarkets. It happens all the time. So, like, or Asian wet markets.
But you're, like, projecting
this menace
your own,
exists.
Like...
So,
anger.
It's really funny how, like, this cultural touchstone is being used to create just one all-timer of a comedic scene, yeah. you know?
Yeah. My favorite series of vignettes has to be the gangster in the white suit and his partner.
There we go.
There's so much to dig into here, but just as a sort of thesis, I love that it is so funny and absurd in the ways in which they use food and talk about food in their relationship. And at the same time, it's incredibly sweet and sincere. And they have a genuinely happy, loving relationship that's lighthearted and sexy and fun. Obviously, the Tom Popo plotline is the heart of the movie, but this plotline with the gangster and his partner is just another really nice encapsulation of everything that Itami wants to say about food and how it brings people together and the kind of relationship that these two have that is based on food and love of food and each other.
There's a reason this is kind of like the B plot of the film, right?
Yes. Mm.
Because Tampopo's plotline is kind of like this pure expression.
It's PG.
Yeah, PG, exactly. That's what I meant by pure. A PG version of like a love of food, you know, and there's an arc there. Yeah. Here is like the love of food is erotic and intense and sexual, and it is. And it's primal, you know what I mean? And there's a reason the film ends with a baby breastfeeding, which is just...
exactly.
Genius final frame. Like, you come into the world, all you want to do is eat.
Yeah.
You know? And where are you eating from? It's, in a way, it's kind of sexual.
In a way. So, in the documentary, Itami narrates that for the white suit and his lover storyline, he wanted to rejoin food and sex in people's lives. He said that when you come into this world, food and sex are so linked because you are literally sucking milk out of a tit. And he wanted to rejoin the joy in having both sex and food at the same place. And
it sounds so perverse, but it's so fun. You know, like, but it doesn't come off that way. You know, it doesn't come off as like this thing that's gross or anything. It's just, it's a little gross, but it's still very fun.
I think it's because whenever sex comes up in Tom Popo, there is an innocence to it. it is about the pure joy and eroticism of those moments. Mm-hmm. There's no power dynamic. And there, I read more of an innocence in that final frame. That, yeah, you come out of the movie wanting to eat, and I think you also come out of the movie wanting to love and, like, connect with people.
Yes. Food is love.
I think that the sex between the gangster and his partner has a real innocence and joy and lightness to it.
Yes.
It's silly.
Even the egg yolk scene.
The yolk.
The infamous egg yolk scene. So if you know Tapopo and you know of the movie but you haven't seen the movie, I'm pretty sure you know the most famous scene from the movie is when
iconic.
This egg yolk is being passed from White Suit's mouth to his lover's mouth back
raw
to White
egg
Suit's
yolk.
Mouth. Raw egg yeah. yolk. And it passes 7 times.
You counted, okay.
No, because in the doc, they rehearse it. So, like, on the 7th time, she has to bite into it. And it has to come out. That's what he said. That's what he said in the doc.
Okay.
And they got these really premium quality eggs, which was provided with, I'm going to say the name of the person, Seiko Ogawa, who's the food stylist. Major shout out to
yes.
Seiko Ogawa, who put in a lot of work sourcing all the food in this movie.
Like 1,000 bowls of ramen.
Thousands of bowls of ramen. And she made it every day. The crew called it the Seiko Ramen after her. And they did countless camera tests just shooting ramen just to find out which bowl of ramen, which way to cook it, looks best on camera.
And what if it tastes good? Does it taste good?
I'm sure it tastes good. I'm
it looks
sure
pretty
it tastes good.
Good.
She cooks the entire thing. She fully cooks the whole meal.
Ramen.
But she sourced really high quality eggs that don't break easily to use in this scene. And it is like it is a long take. The camera just tracks back and forth between the two of them in a tight close up most of the time, and it is sexy. There is no backing. There is no background music. It is just their breathy passing of the egg.
But I think that's important too. There are moments elsewhere in the movie when Itami uses stylistically overt edits or music. And there is a simplicity and an honesty in just staying on the couple without cuts, without non-diegetic music, and just observing as they share this moment. And yeah, it's the absurdity is entirely in the action, but it's still innocent and sweet and a moment of connection for them. And
definitely.
It's, of course, needless to say, directly a metaphor for the build to an orgasm, right? The bursting of the yolk is this moment, and the way she reacts to the bursting of the yolk is clearly very suggestive. But it's still innocent in a way.
I mean, this is related, which is another vignette, which is the pearl, the oyster divers. I was like, this is kind of getting weird.
Yeah, that's maybe a little pushing it a little bit.
But I was just like, because she's clearly very young, right?
Yeah.
And I was like, whoa, this is a little strange. But I think is trying to play it as a sort of, not really loss of innocence, but maybe more of a growth into a sexual maturity. And it doesn't really come off as especially icky. It kind of works. There's a bit of an imagery there because we all know oysters are used as a... Yeah, but also kind of a symbol. For
a vagina.
For, yes. I
wow,
was like, how's the best way to say this?
But sure on deep
thanks, Wilson.
And also, the gangster cuts his lip and there is blood.
Yeah, the
on
blood
the oyster,
that drips onto the oyster. Yeah, and so that, it's kind of done pretty well and like, it works. It's weird that they use the gangster in this situation, maybe, but it's kind of, then you have the other oyster divers just looking at her, making out with him or something, or licking the blood off his lips. And you're just like, okay. But yeah, I find it like, even with that, I think there's some care that he has, like even going towards something that's a little bit more on the edge.
Like if you were to place Juzo Itami on one of those like D&D alignment charts, he is definitely chaotic good. He's like definitely fully chaotic good.
But okay, my favorite sort of vignette is part of the Tampopo plot, but it's a little bit like a coincidence, which is actually the old man in the soba shop. Because that scene almost made me cry, because like this old man just wants to enjoy life, and I guess his helper or assistant or whatever is like,
it's his mistress.
Oh, his mistress? Okay, I was like, I'm not sure. It's just telling him, don't eat all this stuff. And he immediately orders exactly all those things that she said, and then goes from tasting each thing and then to full on gobbling all those things, which then causes him to choke and almost die and is saved by the Tampopo crew. And same thing with talking about being born, like even in death, and you think about the gangster's death, like the last thing on their minds is to eat the best thing.
Yes.
And there's something just so sweet about that.
Fun fact, that scene was shot in a long take, and Hideji Otaki, who plays the old man, ate 2 full bowls.
My God.
Bowl of duck soba noodles and 1 bowl of tempura soba noodles. And he did it for 2 takes, so he had 4 bowls of full bowls of and Itami made a decision prior to this that he was just like, I'm not gonna do coverage, I'm just gonna just play out in this one shot, and we're just gonna use the blocking to move the scene along.
Yes. You said the word blocking. That's where I want to go.
In the shot, you see the Tampopo crew minding their own business, and then your eyes are focused on the old man as he eats, and he starts choking, and then the other Tampopo crew comes over and helps him, and then they start turning him over, like his legs are up, and then
the vacuum comes in.
Yeah, they reconfigure the whole like frame of the scene.
There are a bunch of long takes in this
that are
very well blocked, and I came up with a term for specific moments where I was like, wow, which is chaos blocking. Which this scene is the exact scene, exactly what you described. I was like, the blocking in this like scene of absolute chaos and speed, right? When they start picking him up and everything, it's so messy, but done precisely but not in a way that feels staged. That feels really real and like realistically, authentically messy. And he has many scenes like this, like when you have like the fight, one of the early fights in Tampopo Shop has that kind of messy quality. And I think there are so many scenes where you just look at a block and you're like, wow, like they probably spend so much time thinking about all the little elements and things that have to happen. And then especially in scenes like the one we're talking about in the soba shop, where so many things are going on that they somehow nail it, and I guess 2 takes, is pretty incredible.
And it's thematically linked to what Tampopo wants to talk about with people coming together, right? Think about the scene with the old man choking. It's the Tampopo crew coming into the old man's half of the frame in order to save his life. And I think often in these long take shots, even ones about violence, like the fight that happens under the overpass, it is people coming into each other's part of the frame to interact and come together.
And in extension of that, how the old man repays the Tampopo crew is that he lets Shohei, his driver, who is a ramen master, come help Tampopo in her training in the shop. And it like grows the crew a little bit. It is so great. So heartwarming.
Just before we completely leave the gangster behind, as Ben said, he's thinking about the best meal that he wants to eat with his partner and to share that moment together. And it is so funny. As he's dying, you're like, why is he talking about pigs? And then when he gets to the line about yam sausage, it's so funny. It's so funny. And it's also sweet and sad.
Yeah.
Also, his commitment to falling over every time he gets shot.
Ugh.
Extremely. I was just like, this guy is just taking every single fall.
I will try to stop talking about this behind the scenes documentary. But it highlights a lot of the key scenes of this movie. And it has direct BTS footage of the scene itself being filmed just from another angle. Oh. And you see him, like, really going through it, and they have, like, the rain machines on, and he's, like, shivering in between each take, yeah. And that's real commitment as an actor.
That's the wonderful thing about a director who can really bring a team together behind the scenes to work and create the movie, is that everyone wants to give 110%. Actors, technicians, supporting crew members, everyone is firing on all cylinders and I think enjoying it. That's the sense that I get from Tom Popo.
Yes, it's true. And it's, you know how we talk about films that we love and most of the time it's like, oh, that set was horrible. The director was so mean to people. And it like sort of sours the view of the movie in your head. But when the opposite of that happens, it strengthens the movie in your head and it makes it a more solid film in your mind, and it just makes me so happy that Itami is just one of those directors. And there are just so many great moments in this doc where he like just narrates like very good wisdom as a director. Like at what point Nobuko's trying on costumes for the role of Tampopo, he keeps on going through so many options and he explains to the listener or the viewer that film is a concrete art, so I had her try on everything. And it's just so many ways to see how he sees his movie visually and also on an acting level, and the way that he talks to his actors. It's just so interesting to how he has all the little like action details mapped out in his head, like, oh, after he does this you're gonna like chuckle a little, and it's like even the small things, it's just all mapped out.
It does sound like he has a lot of vision about every minute thing that's going on in the frame.
Yeah,
which
it's controlled chaos.
I don't think every director is able to do that, because sometimes not all directors want to control so much either, because there's artificiality to that. And here I would say there is a heightened world, but there is authenticity to everything that he's able to generate despite the so-called control that he has over what's going on. And it's a very difficult balance to get when you're directing anything. Something that I was thinking about when I was watching the film, I knew about that sports analogy.
Yeah.
But then I was thinking, what's the difference here? Like in sports, you do the thing, you score the goal, you do the touchdown, blah, blah. And that's the moment of glory. But with ramen, you do all the work. And then there's that wait for you to spectate somebody else watching it.
Yeah.
And enjoying it. And that is so different. Like you have to watch somebody enjoy the thing you made, and that's kind of similar to what he's saying. Like, you need time to see other people enjoy your work, and that's when the magic of the film like shows itself, when you see somebody enjoy it.
Right. Making food is a labor of love, and I believe that making movies is also a labor of love.
Yeah.
And it's sort of poetic that he made a movie about making food, because it's making love.
Yeah. That's the main move on making love.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Deep Cut. Please rate and review, because that helps us keep making the show. Be sure to subscribe to us where you listen to podcasts, so you'll know when our next episode drops. You can give us a follow on Twitter and Instagram at Deep Cut Pod. Join us to talk about movies on our Discord server, to which you'll find a link in the description below. Thank you to Justina Yam for her beautiful artwork. I'm Wilson.
I'm Ben.
I'm Eli.
Take care, and we're looking forward to talking about more movies with you next time.